Hello, everybody, and welcome to the American Shoreline Podcast. This is Peter Ravella, co-host of the show.
And this is Tyler Buckingham, the other co-host.
Tyler, there's a lot of money on the American shoreline right now. Congress enacted some very significant legislation in the last couple of years under the leadership of the Biden administration, the bipartisan infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act have directed hundreds of millions of dollars in new funding to the American shoreline for a wide variety of initiatives and programs. And that's going to be the focus of our conversation today, Tyler. What's happening in the summer of money?
It's green out conditions on the American shoreline. There is just so many programs that are funded, that are requesting proposals and funding grants. It's hard to keep track of it all, Peter. I'm on LinkedIn and I see posts just here, there, and everywhere with new acronyms, new dollar amounts, millions of dollars here, millions of dollars there. And it's all very exciting. It all sounds so good. But Peter, we need some expert perspective to understand what's happening here in the summer of money.
That's right. I mean, we have a perfect guest to take us through this topic today. Our very good friend, Derek Brockbank, who is the executive director of the Coastal States Organization and formerly the executive director of the American Shore and Beach Preservation Association. Derek is one of the people who keeps very close tabs on this particular issue, works very hard to make sure Congress does the right thing. And Derek's going to help us understand what's happening on funding for coastal projects around the country.
Very exciting. I don't know. I've got my hand on my wallet. I'm just excited for the summer of money. I'm excited to see what we're going to learn. But first, let's have a quick word from our sponsors.
Support for the American Shoreline Podcast Network and Coastal News Today comes from Geodynamics, an NV5 company. Geodynamics' team of specialists provide accurate surveys of complex coastal environments around the world using the latest technology in marine geology, coastal science, and remote sensing. With customized vessels and sensor configurations, Geodynamics delivers meticulous data products to answer their clients' toughest questions. Visit nv5geospatial.com or geodynamicsgroup.com to learn more about Geodynamics and their solutions that improve lives. And from the Coastal Zone Foundation. The Certified Coastal Practitioner Program from the Coastal Zone Foundation offers courses covering 11 different subject areas, including coastal engineering, ecology, geology, project management, and more. The CCP program emphasizes a multidisciplinary approach to coastal zone management, setting you apart from the competition and demonstrating your commitment to best practices and a code of ethics in your field. With modules available online or as live short courses, the CCP program is accessible to coastal professionals at all stages of their careers. Learn more at coastalzonefoundation.org. And don't forget, subscribe to the CNT Daily Blast newsletter for the latest news and updates from around the American shoreline. Want to support our work? Learn more about sponsorship packages at coastalnewstoday.com/advertising.
Well, Derek Brockbank, welcome back to the American Shoreline Podcast. And in the introduction, I forgot to mention you are also the longtime host, the forever host of the Capitol Beach Podcast on ASPN, one of the great shows we bring to our listeners out there. Derek, thank you for doing that show. And thank you for coming on the American Shoreline Podcast to talk about federal funding for coastal projects.
Always happy to be here with you guys. It's always a fun conversation, and I need to get on doing another Capitol Beach. It's been a month or two, so.
We always love that show. It's always very informative. Yes, I hope you do. And Derek, I know you just came back from ASBPA, the National Conference in Providence, Rhode Island. There was a great deal of energy at the conference this year. If you could, from your perspective as executive director of the Coastal States Organization, give us a summary of the highlights.
Yeah, it was an exciting conference in Providence, Rhode Island. It was the first time in gosh, nearly forever that ASBPA has been in New England. And Given the sort of different type of, the ASBPA conference always has a regional flavor, and given the coastline of New England, there was a lot more discussion of rocky shorelines, of marshes and beneficial use of dredge material using thin layer placement. So it had all the beach and shoreline, you know, nourishment and geology and engineering, but a lot more of the sort of pocket beach and marsh conversation, which was really exciting for me. I grew up in the east end of Long Island, so sort of more New England-y kind of coastline than your mid-Atlantic coastline. So that was really fun. And then, you know, what we're talking about today, there's just so much money that is on its way out to the coast. That was a huge topic of conversation. And related to that is the challenges that are coming with it. How do we get the money out the door? How do we actually turn money into projects? And there were more job postings than I have ever seen at an ASBPA conference. The consulting firms are hiring, the federal agencies are hiring, the states are hiring, everyone is hiring right now. But that also poses challenges, opportunities, but challenges to make sure we have the right people in the right jobs.
So Derek, before we get into the summer of money and kind of understanding the landscape of what's going on here, let's talk a little bit more about the vibe at the conference and all of these jobs and all of this money coming down the pike. To me, as an observer of the American shoreline, this feels like, at least from a United States perspective, that we are confronting climate change in a new way, that this funding is intentionalized to be a major early response. It's certainly not going to do everything, but it seems like it is an explicit response. Would you share that characterization?
Yeah, absolutely. It is a chance to take the first significant step in the right direction towards making our country and our coastlines more resilient, beginning to adapt to climate change. I mean, it almost goes without saying that none of this is effective if we don't get a handle on carbon emissions. But even if we do get the best handle on carbon emissions, so much of this, our impacts are baked in. I mean, we saw this summer in the U.S. and around the world, the kind of impacts that climate change are going to have, that's only going to get worse. And so this is a great first step, but it's also a first step that we need to take and we need to get right. You know, you can't take a first in a lifetime opportunity. I won't say once in a lifetime, but the first time opportunity and mess it up. And so there's a lot of pressure on all of us in the coastal arena to make sure we're using this money appropriately to do sort of just and equitable adaptation.
If I could just follow up on that really quickly, because, you know, I've attended several ASBPA conferences. In fact, Peter, we launched this program at ASBPA. And ASBPA has long been just a super partner for Coastal News Today and the American Shoreline Podcast Network. Derek, you headed that organization back when you started Capitol Beach. It's just a great organization for the American shoreline, but also very importantly, it's a bit of a finger on the pulse type of conference on the subject of coastal resilience and our adaptation to climate change. And Derek, I am wondering, from your perspective, you're talking about all these jobs and everyone hiring. Is it exciting? Are people stoked?
Absolutely.
Because, you know, okay, cool.
Yeah, the energy is. I mean, the energy was palpable. I mean, I think there's a nervous energy, I think, because it is we're doing something that we haven't really done before. We're doing something at scale that has never been done at scale before. So there's a nervous energy to it. But I definitely think, you know, no matter who you're talking to, there's just an excitement there. So, yeah.
Derek, if you could, as the executive director of the Coastal States Organization, which for the listeners out there, if you're not familiar, is the organization that represents the coastal zone programs around the country, the CZMA programs at the state level. What are you hearing from your members, your member states, Derek, about this funding opportunity that are now emerging?
So I would say three things. First, again, that palpable excitement that they have an opportunity. They have more money right now than they have ever really had. So that is tremendously exciting. You know, they can do a lot of the work that they've always wanted to do. The second is that there is a challenge with this money, in that because it came from these the bipartisan infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act, which you mentioned at the top, it is very specifically directed. So the states have to be doing this to put resilience projects, restoration projects, acquisition projects on the ground. So there's it's exciting, but it is very directed. And so it gives states less flexibility than they would prefer. And then the third piece is just looking at the massive amount of funding coming to infrastructure, both resilience, but also looking at offshore energy, offshore wind expansion, looking at a tremendous amount of funds going to the Department of Transportation and state departments of transportation to build roads, to build bridges, to build rails. And there's just a lot more that's going to need to be reviewed in that coastal zone. And so there is some concern that all of this is moving so fast and so quickly that there may not be the chance to fully review and make sure this is being done in ways that are environmentally sustainable and just, and making sure that we're not, you know, replaying some of the mistakes of the past where we were pushing out communities or not giving communities that should have a voice at the table. We're not even giving them any voice at the table.
Well, it's clear that in this administration, and looking over the notice of funding opportunities that have been released to date, there is a tremendous focus on diversity and inclusion and ensuring that underrepresented communities are actively engaged in these programs. It seems like a core feature of these latest rounds of funding. Is that what you're saying?
It is absolutely a core feature, something that the administration is pushing for. I think within the coastal community, everyone sort of wants to see it happen, but we're often working within, you know, bureaucratic structures that have been developed that make it challenging, right? There's a reason these communities have been underserved, and part of it is sort of straight up, you know, bias and prejudice, but part of it is it's really hard to navigate some of these federal structures to get funding, to get, you know, you have to have someone who's really well aware of how grant processes work at the federal government. And if you don't have someone if you can't afford to have someone who can do that, you may not be able to get some of these applications in. So there are definitely systemic challenges that the administration is working to address, but whether those can be addressed on the timescale needed to make sure that this money is going to the right spot is going to be a challenge, at least.
No question it will be, but it is so important. And Derek, you know, obviously, I think you came up with this name, the Summer of Money, which is super, super good name. We've got a lot to talk about within with what's going on in the Summer of Money. But let's talk a bit about money and like what the role that this funding is intended to play on the American shoreline. You know, there's always been programs. They've been funded at various levels, but how important, in your estimation, was it to like plus up these programs with these big slugs of cash that's coming through?
It was incredibly important. You know, you were introducing this and talking about the hundreds of millions of dollars, and you guys know as much about what's going on as anybody. And even you guys are having trouble using the B word, right? I mean, this is billions. This is not hundreds of millions. This is billions. Yeah. We are on an order of magnitude higher than we've ever been before, which is incredible. But it's also essential. Nicole LaBeouf, who's with NOAA, has often talked about the level of funding depressing, you know, having a lesser amount depresses the amount of applications, right? If you have a $10 million available, you're going to get $100 million application. But if you have $100 million available, you may get $1 billion worth of applications. So there is so much out there that needs to be done. Scaling that up, we've seen the need scale up at the same time. So it is, you know, I think just having this amount of money come out at the same time has both been challenging, right? We'd love to sort of space out some of these funds over the course of a few years rather than having it all come out this summer. But it has also really demonstrated that when this kind of level of funding is available, the needs are out there. And we have seen that, you know, tenfold in some of these applications.
It is an overwhelming opportunity. Can you highlight, if you would, a couple of the funding opportunities that are currently available to to coastal professionals, coastal states, local governments and communities, tribes, nonprofit organizations. What's on the top of your list that you're tracking?
Yeah, well, let's talk about the big one, because this is the one that's most recently out, and it is the big one. So NOAA put out probably a dozen different funding opportunities this summer, all of which had very specific, you know, you could do this for this, one's for marine debris, one's for coastal zone management programs, one's for the NEARS. So everyone sort of had their own specific pot of funds available. But the really big one came from the funds from the Inflation Reduction Act, and they called it the Climate Resilience Regional Challenge. So this was something specific that needed to be regional. And it sort of had two tracks, a smaller track and a bigger track. And the smaller track was really about collaborating and ensuring sort of longevity of collaborations at to enhance resilience at a regional scale. And the other one was putting together multiple projects that would enhance a regional resilience. So it wasn't just like, you can't just be one town or one county and say, hey, we're going to do this one project. It had to be multiple things. And consequently, it was big. It was a $575 million were available. Again, like $575 million available. You know, we usually think of like a $100 million proposal or $100 million available being big. This was, you know, almost six times that. It was people could submit letter or organizations, states, communities could submit letters of intent, and then some of them were going to be invited back for a full application. And we just found out those that have invited back for full application just found out 2 weeks ago. And in doing so, NOAA shared that they received 869 applications or letters of intent for approximately $16 billion of projects. So this was oversubscribed almost 30 times. So one in $30 that was applied for is actually going to get it. And this is one of the biggest funding opportunities, you know, I've ever seen in my career. So, you know, they've winnowed that down to about 120 applicants representing about $3 billion. And then it's going to need to get winnowed down again by about a third. So it's, you know, congratulations if you're listening and you've got an application out there. Congratulations. You're still facing a very competitive environment. But just the scale of this has been astonishing. And I think NOAA, because of the way this was set up, there's not going to be many folks that get this grant. But those that do will actually see some transformational resilience happening along their coastline. So that's the biggest and most exciting one.
Climate Resilience Regional Challenge is what it's called, administered by NOAA, $575 million. That is an astonishing number, Derek. You're right. This is only one of the programs. And what I understand is out of the 80 or so applicants who have been invited back to submit full proposals, which, by the way, are going to be submitted in February, right around Valentine's Day, I believe. What do you expect to see in that program? Has NOAA released the list of applicants who were invited back? Have they issued any information about the types of projects? What are you expecting to see in the awards? Or can you speculate? This is totally a crystal ball exercise.
I can certainly speculate. NOAA has said they aren't going to release who's been awarded because, again, well over half of them won't actually receive funding. And so they don't want to necessarily share the ones that aren't going to receive funding. I think from the ones that I have been aware of anecdotally coming out of coastal zone management programs or that coastal zone management programs have been a part of, I mean, they are looking at, regions, multi-county. I'm not sure if there are any multi-state ones that have gone through, but certainly, you know, sections of a coastline where you're looking at multiple restoration projects working together to enhance the community resilience of that area, as well as providing ecological benefits to that area. So I think that's really what NOAA was trying to get at, is these, you know, multiple projects that on an individual basis are good, but the sum is greater than what's this phrase? The whole is greater than the sum of the parts for these projects. So I think that's what they're looking for. And I think just given the scale that they the sheer number of applications, I think they're going to be able to do that and fund some really good game-changing projects.
And that term regional is just so interesting to me. You know, this has long been, Derek, a thing that we have talked about at ASBPA conferences or podcasts, that, you know, the jurisdictional boundaries of a city or a county don't really matter when you're talking about geology in a sediment cell and the way that the ocean or a coastline is interfacing with climate change. It just doesn't really matter. So I guess what I'm curious to know is, how would you rate the as a community of practice, how ready were we to think regionally for this project? Now, obviously, we've got $16 billion in requested funding, so we got our act together in some respect, but were we ready to think regionally?
I think we were ready to work regionally, but I think we could have done a better job of having been more ready. I was part of a number of collaborations or participating in a number of collaborations that had just literally dozens of calls in the 2 months we had to develop the letters of intent, where we were bringing together different partners, different counties, different cities, different watershed groups within a region to develop comprehensive regional proposals. And it was extraordinary. And I think those conversations happened. Perhaps those conversations should have already happened, and we should have had more opportunity to have, you know, plans in place and have things that we could just sort of take off the shelf and say, this is our regional opportunity. So, you know, I think it helped. It helped us to look regionally. And I think there was a willingness to do these regional projects, but maybe we should have been doing that a bit earlier.
You know, what comes to mind to me is like the Apollo program, where, you know, the United States, aerospace industry, in some respects had the building blocks to build advanced rockets and the computers necessary to like do stuff in space, but the funding wasn't there, so it wasn't happening. And then the funding comes together and we start to combine the technologies and combine the expertise to make, you know, the space program. And in some respects, I think that in the summer of money, we're seeing a similar kind of evolution. Like all of a sudden we can take all of these, expertise that we have in local communities that are kind of small. These are smaller scale things. I mean, we're up a scale of magnitude. It's just a different thing. So now we get to think about our climate solutions differently. And I think that that's like an important part of this as well. It's not just the projects, ladies and gentlemen. It's how we're thinking about the projects. That's my thought. Peter, what do you think about that?
Well, I do think money is the grease for the smooth operation of the machine. And as Derek has pointed out, and what is clear in the regional climate resiliency funding opportunity is, boy, the needs are incredibly large. And even in excess of the billions of dollars now available. But I'm thinking, Tyler, there's going to be the key thing here from my standpoint is the performance of the agencies and the performance of the recipients of these funds. This is an opportunity to do good work. The programs need to be well managed. The funds need to be responsibly allocated and executed. Derek, can you talk a little bit about sort of this is an important inflection point for the coastal industry in America and for the American shoreline. This has to be done right. This is resources of historic scale. Can we pull it off as a community of coastal professionals?
Yes, but your point is absolutely well taken. It's going to be a challenge. NOAA is going to be pushing more money out the door, or at least contracting more money in the next 12 months than I think they've probably done in any sort of 12-month, if not, you know, multi-year period. And that's going to take a lot of work. They are staffing up, and I give a tremendous credit. They have been able to staff up. They're bringing on good folks. But it's going to need to, they're going to need to get this money contracted and out the door really quick. As we talk, they're actually undergoing some sort of system work. If you're a current recipient of a NOAA grant, you know that you can't be submitting your grant reports. You can't be getting funding for that. This month is a month they're taking to totally overhaul their system, which is challenging, but hopefully sets themselves up to do, you know, to be better off moving forward as the programs and the funds get bigger. There was also, you know, some of the real sort of nuancy stuff that doesn't always seem that important, but there was a new rule coming out from OMB, or it wasn't a rule, but a proposal coming out from the Office of Management and Budget looking at federal grants and looking to sort of update things because it hadn't been updated in over a decade. And so, you know, there's limitations on how much you can charge for equipment that was just, you know, just we just need to keep up with inflation. Different things that are like that that need to be updated and make sure that, you know, the sort of basic functioning of government can keep pace with the kind of project work that is happening. And you know, that sort of leads me into one of the so we've been talking about the best of times. That also leads me into the worst of times, which I think we have to talk about, which is we need a functioning government. And we are, you know, once again under threat of a government shutdown. And you know, the challenges that that could do, you know, if there's a long government shutdown, that could really pose challenges to the ability of getting this money out the door and working. And so, you know, we are in sort of the best of times, the worst of times here in DC with, you know, more money than we've ever thought of going towards coastal resilience, but we can't agree whether we should pay government employees to do the work. So,
yeah, that's a, if there's a government shutdown, which I believe it is possible in November, if the House of Representatives doesn't get it together here, obviously the effort to organize these funding opportunities to receive the applications, review and award contracts would all cease. And the timelines in these funding programs are really quick, actually, and it's a concern. I would like to ask you specifically about the additional funding made available to the coastal zone management programs around the country. I believe more than $100 million in competitive funds have been put into the coffers for state coastal management programs. What do you expect in the implementation of those funds? What do you expect to see from your coastal management program community as they access these additional funds?
Good question. I mean, this is a bit of an oversimplification, but I think the funds that have gone out to date and that will probably be going out this year. So these are funds that came from the bipartisan infrastructure law. It was funding to be spent out over 5 years. And so NOAA has at least thus far put out a proposal last year, a proposal this year, and then anticipate future proposals. And I think what we've seen so far are people taking their best projects that they have on the shelf and just sort of dusting them off and saying, let's get this one actually funded because it's good work. And so, you know, there's some land acquisitions that have been, they've been waiting to, you know, buy some important areas to protect. There's some restoration projects that are sort of easy to, no restoration project is easy, but, you know, easier to move forward. The shovel ready stuff. But because this has that 5 year window, that has also allowed states to be working this last year and this year to prepare for what could be even better projects going forward, right? So this is not just the dust off your shelf, you know, dust off the project on your shelf, but actually let's think about what makes sense to do moving forward. And we know the money's going to be there. You know, it's always a bit hard when you're working on an annual appropriation cycle and you never really know exactly how much you're going to get in out years. It can be hard to really plan for that. But because this funding is available over 5 years, it has already been appropriated. It's, you know, barring a Congress trying to claw the money back, it's not going to be taken away. It allows programs to think forward. And I think we're seeing some of that. And again, I think that also, the conversation earlier about regional work and collaborative work, that's allowed for better partnerships. You know, communities, if you can go into an underserved community and say, listen, we know we have this funding available. So if it takes us a year or two to figure out the best way to spend it, we can take that year or two to figure out. It's much better than going into a community and saying, hey, I know we've, you know, pulled the rug out from under you half a dozen times over the past decade, but trust us, we'll be fine this time. But oh, we're also waiting on Congress to fund us, you know. So this is allowing those deeper relationships to form, knowing that you have funds available in future years.
Totally. And it gets the creative juices going a little bit too. I mean, because ultimately the way, you know, you're saying dusting off the old projects, shovel ready. I mean, that project was conceived under the constraints of pre-summer of money constraints. And we're, not only has our world changed, our culture has changed vis-a-vis climate change, the science is changing vis-a-vis coastal management. I'm not saying that the project, the Shovel Ready project, isn't a good project, but perhaps our understanding of the broader landscape has shifted a little bit. And Derek, that's really what I want to ask you about. If you could describe the landscape out there here in the Summer of Money, we have these two monumental pieces of legislation that pumped the money in, but then we have our existing government agencies that are implementing it. We have all of our existing, you know, your organization, the Coastal States Organization, you got ASBPA, you've got all the existing engineering company. I mean, like we're in the bed we made, you know, this is what we inherited. What is the kind of situational report from a landscape scale looking at the whole American shoreline here?
I mean, again, I think this collaboration, I think we've been talking about, you know, adaptation for a decade now, maybe more, but certainly seriously looking at it for a decade. So I think there is a readiness and a willingness. I think we can scale up, but I think it's going to take, you know, as we've been talking about, it's going to take a lot of different people working together. We're going to need to sort of smooth out some of the kinks in the permitting and regulatory. We're going to need to smooth out some of the kinks in the contracting processes. And then folks are going to need to hire mm-hmm. up. And, you know, the reality is I think folks are going to need to be hiring, I won't say underqualified folks, but there's going to be a generation of coastal engineers that are coming on and doing big projects as soon as they get their first job, right? It's not, this is not a like, well, let's train you up on this little, you know, postage stamp restoration project in a marsh. It's like, come on board and you're working on a big project. And so, you know, there's going to be challenges to that too. I think it's a, you know, like you said, with the Apollo project, it's, you know, it's an incredible opportunity, but we need to seize the moment.
Derek, I want to shift gears a little bit. Do you mind if we talk a little bit about wind power?
Ooh, goodness, wind power, catching me off guard. Yeah, sure, let's do it.
Well, I've been, you know, in watching what's happening in the BOEM initiatives, the Biden administration's effort to expand offshore wind power opportunities around the country. They've lease sales in the Gulf of Maine being announced this week in the Gulf of Mexico, off of Massachusetts, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey. There are wind sale opportunities on the West Coast of California and even up into Oregon. So really all around the American shoreline, a real effort to expand the wind power industry offshore as a climate, obviously a climate response strategy. But what I've noticed, Derek, is there has been a recent sort of political pushback here, and I think a well-orchestrated campaign to sort of sully the idea of offshore wind power. There's been sort of nefarious claims that the offshore wind industry is already killing hundreds of whales on the American shoreline, particularly on the Atlantic side. The industry doesn't really exist at this moment. It's a very questionable attack, but getting some traction. And the wind power industry has been challenged in court over the course of this year. So from your standpoint at the Coastal States Organization, what are you seeing and hearing on offshore wind? And can you look down the road a little bit and tell us what you think, where this may all shake out?
Sure. There's a lot there to unpack.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the coastal zone management programs are there to manage and balance mixed uses in the coastal zone, right? Like that's sort of the fundamental principle of coastal management is you have to balance development, recreation, conservation, energy production. There's a whole bunch of stuff that you need to balance. And so that's what they're trying to do. And I think everyone on the coast, almost everyone on the coast, recognizes that if we are going to continue to have a coast that anywhere resembles the kind of coast that we have known and loved our entire lives, that we are going to need to get off fossil fuels, right? We can't keep doing this. There's going to need to be carbon capture. There's going to need to be, you know, carbon dioxide removal. There's going to need to be all that. But ultimately, we're going to need to move away from fossil fuels. We're going to need to stop burning carbon. We're going to need to start creating energy in other ways. And so that means getting energy from renewable sources everywhere. And it's going to, and there are going to be environmental challenges to that no matter what, right? Like if you put up a big solar farm in the middle of the desert, you're undermining desert tortoise habitat, right? So, you know, there's going to be offsets and there are going to be challenges, but I think getting offshore wind is absolutely one of the critical pieces to achieving a renewable future. And so really what our coastal management programs are doing is trying to do that in ways that that balance other uses. And so I think most of our program managers are trying to figure out ways to get that offshore wind to happen, but to do it in ways that can support in other environmental benefits too. And, you know, to your point, yeah, I think there has been some significant and coordinated pushback against some of the wind projects, but you know, that I feel like anytime you have a shift in energy infrastructure, that's going to happen. So we just need to push through it.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that. All of these new energy technologies are market share issues in the end of the day. Who is going to produce the power? Who's going to make the money off of power production? And as you shift those generation resources, you're also shifting economic horsepower and profits. And so that automatically means there's going to be a great deal of interest in how these things are rolled out. The coastal management programs are the forum and have been for 50 years now, where these multi-use interests are reconciled to some degree. Are the coastal management programs taking up new policy directives at this point in preparation for offshore wind? What are you seeing from a programmatic standpoint for coastal states to become more prepared for this discussion?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the biggest thing that I'm sort of aware of that's happening is a collective look at how fisheries management, how to balance offshore wind with fisheries management. the northeastern states, and that actually sort of includes the mid-Atlantic states, so not just the New England, but mid-Atlantic and northeastern states have been working together to put together a framework for fisheries mitigation compensation. So if you're building a wind turbine, operating a wind turbine, and it has impact on the fisheries, how do the states work together to address that? And I think that's particularly important in the Northeast, where the states are smaller. And so, you know, if you're the wind turbines off of Rhode Island are impacting the fisheries in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, potentially Connecticut, and New York as well. So you got a bunch of states that need to collaborate on that. So they're putting together different frameworks. That's something we're also seeing develop in Congress. Senator Markey has been working on legislation. Nothing's been introduced yet, but working on legislation to address fisheries mitigation issues nationally. The challenge there is that it looks different whether you're in New England and you're dealing with four states on one fishery, or if you're off the coast of California where you've got essentially just one state.
One of the things that I've seen change, or rather I hope will change, I see a hang up, is that, you know, here on the American shoreline for a long time, we've kind of adopted this conservation mindset to our beaches and shores, our ocean spaces. It's a little NIMBYism. It's like, hey, yo, don't mess with the ocean and coast. Don't build your wall. Don't armor the shore, which of course I support all this stuff, but there's a bit of that too with offshore wind and other, you know, the measures that we're going to have to take to confront climate change are going to require, to use the other expression, you know, if you want to make an omelet, you're going to have to break some eggs. We're going to have to break some eggs on the American shoreline. Culturally, this is a shift, Derek. How would you say coastal professionals and coastal management organizations at the state level and at the federal level are confronting this cultural shift?
I think it's something we probably could be doing a better job of. I've definitely heard managers talk about the idea that, you know, the silent majority want offshore wind, but the very vocal minority, the ones that show up at meetings, the ones that, you know, picket and have signs and put placards in their front yards are the ones that don't. And so, you know, since we're working on idioms today, that the squeaky wheels get the grease, right? And so it's how do you balance that? How do you make the right decisions that support the majority of the population, even if they're not the ones that they're speaking up? And, you know, that's, you know, that gets back to organizing and collective action. And, you know, functioning democracy in some ways. And I feel like it's we're sort of in a challenging time on all those regards now. But I think we need to continue to work through it. We need to continue to, you know, message it and push the correct science, but also push the sort of just understanding that just because you don't have the time to, you know, speak out at a public hearing doesn't make your voice less important.
Yeah, the never-ending challenges of the American shoreline, Derek, something I know you've been working with for decades now. These balance of interests are the key. Let's talk a little bit more about other funding opportunities. You know, I think Tyler was saying it's just a blizzard. There's so many programs out there. There's so many funding opportunities. How can potential applicants track this? Is there a way to keep track of what's out there? Any recommendations that you give to your state coastal program managers how to keep track of what's out there and how to apply?
It's really hard because the White House is keeping track of all the funding that's coming out of the BIL and the Inflation Reduction Act, but there's so much of that has nothing to do with coast. You know, it's broadband and who knows what, you know, roads and transportation and lots of different stuff. So it's sort of hard to track there. Obviously, NOAA has a lot of different funds coming out of them. So you can go to NOAA's website and just Google NOAA infrastructure, and you'll get to their infrastructure page. But there isn't a great site. I don't have anyone. We at CSO have been managing our own web page for our members, but that's for funding that's explicitly available to coastal zone management programs. So it's not something that would be helpful to the public. So I don't know if I could. I know we didn't want to sort of laundry list out programs, but I wanted to flag three that are still open that I'd hope if folks haven't heard about, they can take a quick look at.
Please do.
So the first one is Transformational Coastal Habitat Restoration. And this is coming out of NOAA Fisheries, but it is not explicitly fisheries. It does need to be a restoration project that can help enhance or protect fisheries habitat, but it is very much intended to also be coastal resilience, right? These needs to be projects that are supporting fish, but also supporting people. And this is $240 million. So this would be, you know, under many years, the biggest available pot of funds out there. So do check that one out. That one's coming up due pretty soon in mid-November. There is a one similar to that that is specifically for underserved communities. It's also coming out under fisheries. So it's for communities that are trying to develop capacity to start doing habitat restoration. And so that one is $45 million, of which I think $20 million is specifically for tribes, but $25 million is for any sort of underserved, self-defined underserved community. And again, this funding is exciting because it is funding to help the capacity of that community to do this work. So you don't necessarily need to have a specific project in mind. You can bring on a staffer who can help apply for grants. You can bring on a consultant who can help you think through the vulnerability work. So that's a really cool one. That's coming up in December, and that's also through NOAA Fisheries. So again, if you go to NOAA Fisheries, you can Google this. And then the last one, and this is another one of the giant ones, but coming out of FEMA, the BRIC and the Flood Mitigation Assistance. They just put out their announcements a couple weeks ago. Those applications are due early in the new year, but it's another $1 billion coming out of the Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities program at FEMA. And this isn't just coastal, right? So this can be, you know, resilience to heat, resilience to, you know, earthquakes, but obviously some of the biggest hazards are along our coastline. So it certainly would encourage communities to look at that. And then similarly, the flood mitigation assistance is how do you reduce impacts from flooding? And similarly, it can be from rainfall events, riverine flooding, but some of the biggest flood events are on our coast. And so it would definitely encourage coastal communities to look at that. So that's $1.8 billion in funding from FEMA that will be due early in the new year. So it is also the fall of money as well as the summer of money.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we might have to go with the year. I think, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act, the bipartisan infrastructure law, unprecedented levels of investment in America and in particular the American shoreline. It's an exciting time and a challenging time. Derek, final thoughts on what you expect? Let me ask you this. Looking back 2 years from now, what would you like to see as a result of this huge investment? Obviously, not a lot gets built in 2 years, but if you were going to sort of sketch the future out, what you would like to see, what do you hope is accomplished with this level of funding now available?
Yeah, the two-year time horizon is interesting because I feel like in some ways the two-year might be the most challenging because I don't think you're going to see any on-the-ground, not that many on-the-ground projects completed. So I hope there's been a lot of advancement in, I hope there's a lot of contracts in place, a lot of grants have gotten their proposals accepted and submitted, and I hope to see permitting happening at a scale and a time frame that right now seems a little inconceivable because it's going to need to, right? You're going to need to get these permits through. You're going to need to do a lot of permitting. So I really hope that's shaped up in 2 years. And then maybe looking ahead to the 5-year horizon, I hope we don't really do ribbon cuttings on coastal restoration projects because where do you cut the ribbon from? But, I hope there are ribbon cuttings multiple times a week across the country saying, this project has been restored. This is how we're becoming more resilient. This is why we're not going to be, anytime you do a restoration and resilience project, you're either helping a community not have to move from the next coastal hazard, or you're at least buying time so that the when they need to move out of the harm's way is going to be in the 100-year scale, not in the 10-year scale. So I think we need to see those ribbon cuttings on restored lands in 5 years.
Yeah. Permits, authorizations to do the work, then well-engineered projects, and then actual results on the ground. That's what we're hoping to see in the next 2 to 5 years. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Derek Brockbank. He is the executive director of the Coastal States Organization and also the host of the Capitol Beach podcast on ASPN. It's really a great show. Google it up. Derek keeps them all together on his website. Great to listen to Derek all the time. We really appreciate you coming on to talk to us about the summer of money.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
To build the hotels, my father's and mine was you.